Okay. Today is Monday, February 9th, and I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2015. Gavel again. And Rick, will you please give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I will be brief since we have experts in the room. This does direct the Department of Human Services to adopt rules for employment-related daycare subsidies that allow parents one-year certification regardless of changes in employment status, allows parents to attend school, extend benefits to self-employed parents, reduces payments and co-payments for child care facilities that meet tiered quality standards, and ensures compliance with federal law by allowing the Office of Child Care to visit and conduct on-site inspections. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, and I'd like to call up Speaker Tina Kotek, Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, and Representative Jessica Vega Peterson.
Madam Speaker. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative from House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 2015 today. My testimony should be online, so I won't read it, but let me just highlight. We all know how important child care is for working families. We have a lot of parents out there juggling home responsibilities, work responsibilities, and helping them afford quality child care is important. One of the most important things we have in our menu of supports for families is the employment-related daycare program, and that's what this bill is about. Last year, I convened a small group of folks, including my two colleagues up here at the dais with me today, Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Vega Peterson, along with some child care experts, advocates who worked on this program for a long time, as well as the agency people involved from Department of Human Services and Department of Education. And the question was, here we are moving out of the recession. What do we do with this program now? How do we make it stronger? How do we make it more reliable and functional for the families who are involved? We don't just want to serve more families. What can we do in the program to make it work better for the families who might be on irregular schedules, who have difficulties having the same provider month after month? So we really had a great conversation about the program itself. And what you have here is the result of that work. It's not complete. I'm going to talk about a couple amendments that are coming. But you'll see in my testimony the highlights of the bill. One of the main things that came out of the discussion was, how do you stabilize the program for families who have changes in their work status over the course of their eligibility? Right now, if you have a significant change in your work hours, you're either going to pay substantially more in your copay, or if you lose work, you might lose work altogether temporarily and then lose child care, and then you're out trying to find a new job. So what you see in the bill is giving the department the ability to have 12 months of continuous eligibility for the families who get into the program, which is really about a stable setting for the child as well. We know that if there's continuity of care for the child, that they're not changing that setting every couple of months, it's much better for the child. It's much more stability for the parents who are in the program. So you see that as a primary part of this bill. There will be an amendment coming that also asks the department to look at, how do you deal with the cliff effect of when, even after the first year of on the program, parents start to make more money and then they lose eligibility altogether, or the copays are just so high they can't afford it. Directing the department to deal with that issue, so into the second and third or however long that they need the support, families have can stay on the program or at least manage through the improved, you know, the improved status that they have in their life in terms of additional income, but not lose their child care support so abruptly. The bill also expands parent eligibility in that back in 2009, because of budget cuts, we removed self-employed parents from the program's eligibility, which at the time was really disheartening, but we were driven to make a whole lot of decisions. Doesn't make any sense today. There are a lot of parents out there who are entrepreneurial. They are running their own businesses, but they need childcare. And they need this program. Also, families who are working but also trying to pick up some college coursework also need child care for those couple extra hours a week. This bill would continue what we've started to allow the program to provide child care during those classroom hours as well as the work hours. One of the other big discussions we had in the work group was quality. We've had very limited connection between the employment-related daycare program and quality incentives. We all want higher quality for all the parents out there. It's a challenge across the system, regardless of income. So this bill would direct the department to work on some pilots to connect those providers, those licensed providers who are in the quality rating system that we've created in the state, to not only, if a parent chooses them voluntarily, the provider would get a little bit more money and the parent would have a smaller copay as an incentive to get into those settings. I think the challenge for us will be how much of those incentives we can do and still do all the other things, but making that quality attachment is important. There's in the amendment that's coming, there's also going to be a discussion about those other sets of providers out there, which is about half of the other providers, which are the license exempt providers, the family, friends, and neighbor care providers who aren't in a licensed setting but nonetheless are on the program providing care. They also need some help improving their quality. They're very anxious to learn more about best practices and evidence-based practices. So the amendment will talk about helping those providers as well have access to quality improvement. As unlicensed or license exempt providers, they're not in the quality rating system, so they need a separate quality improvement system. And lastly, you also see in the bill there's some language to say to empower the state to implement some new federal regulations to have access to the federal child care block grant dollars we have in the state. Those family, friends, and neighbor providers need to have additional health and safety checks from the state. We're trying to make them as easy and not onerous as we can, but there is some of that has to happen. And so you see some language in the bill to make those visits happen as well. They need to have some site visits with those providers. So all in all, what you see is an attempt to say, not only serve more families, and by the way, I do think we should serve more families. We serve about 8,000 families per month on average. I'd like to see us increase that another 1,000 or 1,500 families who are actually in the program. If you do that, plus all these incentives and enhancements that we're talking to make this program really meet its outcomes, you're probably talking about $60 million of new investment into employment-related daycare. So this bill is the policy vehicle for that budgetary discussion. I hope you can support it throughout the session. This is a really important conversation. I think the time is now to really improve the program for working families, and we have a great opportunity to do so with this bill. So thank you very much.
Representative Vega Peterson. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Northwest Portland, Beaverton, unincorporated Washington County. Thank you very much for inviting me to offer some testimony today on this important bill. It's been a real privilege to work with Speaker Kotek, Representative Vega Peterson, and others who are committed to this. I want to highlight a couple of things that the Speaker mentioned and then add a couple of more. The first is our ultimate goal is to help every Oregonian get to self-sufficiency. We do not want to be in the business of providing ongoing services for people in Oregon, and Oregonians don't want to be in the position of needing these extra services. We firmly believe that, with very few exceptions, the vast majority of people in our state want to be self-sufficient. They do not want to depend on the government for anything. That being said, we know that there are times in people's lives when, because of economic changes, because of family changes, a whole host of reasons, people do need some additional support. And the thing I always like to remember is something that I heard first actually from Senator Franken from Minnesota, who talked about his wife's family who went through some pretty tragic circumstances and how, with some government assistance, they got to true self-sufficiency. And he said they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, but the government had to give them the boots. And I think that's a way that we can think about ERDC in this context. I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of the points and why we think these are going to be important. Some of you may remember that in the past for the Oregon Health Plan, prior to the changes that came with the Affordable Care Act, it used to be that you had to recertify for OHP every 3 months, every 6 months, and finally we switched it to a year. And that made a big difference because of the continuity of care my other hat is that I'm a family physician, and it was really tough on my patients at that point, speaking now as a family doctor, because they'd have health insurance and then they wouldn't be able to get the paperwork done because there was something else going on, and then they'd lose important care for themselves and their families. People who are in the position of needing ERDC are often facing multiple struggles, and asking them to recertify every month when their wages change by even a small percent because they picked up more shifts or they did other things to help support their families better is unrealistic and unreasonable. And it means that they spend more time doing government paperwork than getting themselves back on their feet. So this change to 12-month eligibility will go a long way toward, as the speaker said, improving continuity and bonding between the children and their care providers, but also in terms of making sure that the government isn't putting too much red tape on things instead of helping people actually do the work they need to do. With regard to the issue of self-employed families, I would remind people that small businesses create 90% of new jobs in the state. And if we're looking at ways to create jobs, we have to remember that supporting people who are self-employed is exactly a way to do that. And while some people claim that you can work at home by yourself when you have small children, as the mother of three children, I will tell you that is not the truth. And I know plenty of people who can attest to that fact, and I'm guessing that many of you at the dais could also. So it's really important to support people who are self-employed and allow them to grow those businesses, allow them to bring on other employees, do the things that we need to do to support entrepreneurship in this state. The last thing that I would particularly point out is that the money that we invest in this program goes straight back into our economy. This money is used to pay child care workers who in turn around and spend that money. And that's really important. This is not money that's sort of disappearing into some black rabbit hole. This is money being paid to support people who care for our youngest, most vulnerable Oregonians. And the quality improvement system that the speaker referenced is going to make a big difference to making sure that we compensate these workers fairly for getting the training that they need and implementing the practices that we know will help our children be ready to learn when they get to school. So I, like the speaker, urge your support for this bill, and I look forward to answering questions as needed.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I am the state representative for House District 47 in East Portland, and I also am grateful for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2015 today. So a lot has already been said about what this bill does and some of the reasons for it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the workgroup experience that we had there. Going into this workgroup, we know that there's been a lot of work that's already been done by the legislature in the past few sessions around early learning and early childhood development. And one of the goals was looking at a way to align the work that had been done in early learning with the ERDC. So that was one of the goals that the workgroup had. We also, as Speaker Kotek said, wanted to look at how to align our state policies with some of the new federal requirements that were coming in, as well as look at a way of creating some consistency and stability for the children and the parents in the ERDC program, and really prioritize the goals to balance how we could expand the ERDC program to bring more people into it, more families who have been on the waiting list for this program into the program, but at the same time balance the quality of care and enriched learning environment that we know is so important for early childhood development. And what you see before you is the result of that work group, and I think that we've done a good job in balancing a lot of those different things to bring this before you today. One of the things that I think is really important when you talk about this bill and some of the other policies that we're looking at this session is that, you know, historically the care of children, especially very young children, have been the work of the home environment. But we have more and more families working today. And so we are looking at now how we're having more public support and more school support for children. We're seeing this play out in the types of learning experiences children have as they enter school. And we see that in the achievement gap in children as they're entering kindergarten. Even though we think that preschool and pre-K programs are fairly popular now. I recently went on a tour of Lincoln Park Elementary School in the David Douglas District, and of the 30 children that were in the kindergarten class, the teacher guessed that probably only 5 or 6 had had any kind of formal school experience entering into kindergarten. To me, that shows that then the daycare and the childcare experiences that those children are having before they enter kindergarten are that much more important, and which is one of the reasons why I was so happy to work on the work group this summer. And we also know that one of the things that's very important and that this bill addresses, the policy of the ERDC addresses, is a two-generational approach to approaching childhood investment. So last year, I had the opportunity to be an early learning fellow with the NCSL program. And one of the things that we talked about there was how many states, including some of the work that we're doing in Oregon, really looks at two-generational approaches for early learning investment, meaning that you're not only looking at the needs of the child and what the child needs in order to succeed in school and be ready to learn, but it's also what the parent needs, what supports they need in order to provide the right environment for that child. And this program right here, the ERDC, is a really good way about that. And I'm just going to put in a little plug because there's also a two-generational bill that's over in the Senate right now that I hope you guys will see later this session. But the work that we did in the committee was very thoughtful and produced some really good policy, so I definitely recommend your support of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
That's great. And just a heads up, we do have 12 remaining speakers on this issue, so don't feel like this is your only chance, but it is your only chance. It is your only chance to ask legislators some questions. So do you have any questions? Representative Stark?
Yes, thank you. I mean, how can I pass up the opportunity to ask the speaker questions? So couple different things. One will revert to amendments that you guys I've heard are coming, but we haven't seen. And one, just I want to understand the goals on this. As I think through the idea between 12 months, extending that eligibility to guarantee the 12 months, extending, I haven't read it, but I've been told that the goal is to increase the exit eligibility to 250% of the poverty level. So based on that math, you will have a lot more people, people staying in the program a lot longer, which decreases the number of people that can come into the program. So I'm wondering, when you recommend increasing the caseload by 1,500, so that's 8,500 to 10,000 or so, does that mean, is that just to keep the caseload really at par of entrance levels, or are we also attempting to increase the number of people who can come into the program? That's one.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair, sir, great question. That is the challenge, because one of the reasons we've been able to serve so many families in employment-related daycare is because of the cycling on and off the program. And we will, if by passing this bill, we're going to stop that, right? There will be some stability. Now, people will have change in circumstances. Their child might be going off to school, or they might someone might move out of state. So there will be some turnover in the program. But you'll have a lot more people staying in the program for a lot longer. And so that's why I think it's imperative that we not only talk about making the program stronger and more stable for those families, but you have to add some ability to have more families in it, because you're going to have that exact same problem. The problem you identified is real. We'll have people staying in the program until their life circumstance changes where they no longer need it, but we have a lot of families who need that support. So it's a balancing act. Do you have the best program you can have and get as many families in it, or do you just have, you know, a watered down program and try to get more people in? And I think we're going with the make the program really work and get as many families as you can in there.
And a couple things that I'm just hoping to see in the amendments, or maybe I'll hear more discussion on it today, but the other day with those who came to visit me, they didn't have these answers yet. Just a couple concerns on it are, one is with the, as people have testified on the tax credit, some of the tax credits that we've been discussing, one of the criticisms of the ERDC is lack of public awareness and access to it. So I'm interested in hearing how we are planning on resolving that. And then the other is, as you talk about increasing standards of care and giving incentives for these qualifying or non-exempt agencies to increase their levels of care, and the way we talk about incentivizing that, I want to make sure that we are being very cautious with the exempt groups, grandma, grandpa, those who are watching, that we're not making it overly biased toward an institutional type setting And I haven't seen those yet, so I look forward to seeing something along those lines.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Stark, you're absolutely right on that. The one thing on the flexibility that you have in that family and grandma and mm-hmm. friend care is never going to be wholly replaced, but we want to make sure there's quality on both sides of right. providers. But it's something that, and also making sure demographically we're not disadvantaging access to certain types of providers, because a lot of providers might not be in the quality rating system yet. So there's a whole lot of issues there. Senator, did you?
No, I think you've done it perfectly.
Great question, so thank you.
Representative Parrish?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate this. And Speaker, your staff did come in and talk to me about the bill. Forgive me for being late. There's a line in there about increasing self-employment, and I heard that, you know, Rep. Peluso said you kind of addressed that a little bit, but I'd like to go and dig on that a little bit deeper. Apparently, self-employed was in there before it came out. Do you have a sense of what that actually looks like? Is it based on net income? Is it based on, you know, gross sales? Like, how do you define need and self-employment, and particularly given the sheer volume of business write-offs and things that people can use to bring their net income down to, you know, a marginal level and tap into the program, but may actually not, you know, have the actual need, but just representing their income?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, great question. I don't know the answer. I don't know if DHS is here. Maybe after the people come to testify, they could. And I don't remember how self-employed was handled in terms of income, but we should figure that out because it's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we have Rhonda Pradzinski in the audience, and maybe she can come up at the very end in case there are other questions that come up. Yep. Representative Hayden?
Yeah, Chair Kenny-Gayer, thank you. I apologize for being late. They held us over in Healthcare Committee a little long. And last Human Services Committee, we talked about the tax credits, and one thing that I'm starting to explore is figuring out how we can take the tax credit and get it back to the folks that qualify for that tax credit on a monthly basis so they don't go throughout the year and then get a big check in the spring. And so I've been working a little bit on that concept, and one of the feedback concerns that I've been getting with that is that it's not stable enough. What if after 6 months, you know, that the state is taking too much risk, because after 6 months that person might get a job. The quote was for $250,000. I said, well, that's probably not likely going to happen. So my question is, it seems that you're stabilizing that with this bill. If you're stabilizing it with this bill, would there be room for a tax credit for a second-year qualified family to take an average of those 12 months that they get and have that taken back out of their paycheck so they get it on a monthly basis to help them pay for that child care for the part that the subsidy doesn't cover, if it doesn't cover 100% for all of the families? Is there room for that discussion to kind of pay it forward, if you will?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, great questions for this entire committee this morning. I think the model of a blended model, which I think is what you're describing here, mm-hmm. Representative, is a really good model. And as we look at exactly where the income cutoff should be, whether it's, you know, this is what you're eligible up to X percent of the federal poverty level for ERDC, and then beyond that you get a tax credit, which would essentially be analogous to what we're doing now for people who buy health insurance through the commercial exchange, right? If you have a certain percentage of the federal poverty level, you get a certain tax credit. I think the concern that was raised yesterday is probably not too big a problem, partly because of the point you made. Somebody's unlikely to go from making $25,000 to $250,000 a year overnight. But also because we have a model now with the Affordable Care Act for how we deal with these tax credits, right? We give them a certain amount, either on a monthly or annual basis, and we issue a 1095, which is the form saying here's how much tax credit you got. And then we true it up at the end, essentially, when people submit their income taxes, both with Oregon's Department of Revenue and the Federal Department of Revenue. So I think there is definitely room, from my understanding of all this, for a blended continuum model. And exactly where the cutoff is for the percentage of federal poverty level, I think I'll leave that to the certified economic smart people, which I'm not one of, despite doing Ways and Means till my ears turn blue. I think we can look at some models there, but I think we do have mechanisms in place to true those things up over time.
Follow up comment? Just a follow-up comment, if I could, and it would it be possible to combine like the 2115, the 2114, the 2113, the 2091, which are tax credits for child care that, that we already have there? Seems like, you know, low-income people are low-income. They have kids. They need child care. Can't we do that in one bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, great question. We do a lot of, we come up with a lot of different ways to help families. And, you know, I was actually at Oregon Food Bank in 2001 when we fought to get the Working Family Child Care Credit expanded, made it refundable, moved the income level so we could help a whole slew of families at different income levels to have some help with their tax, their child care costs. Hugely important program. And then we do the direct subsidy route, which is this program where we're saying, okay, we're going to give some providers some direct subsidy and the parents are going to co-pay, you know, the best situated parent is someone who might have both, because they could still take, mm-hmm. you know, their copay and deduct it as a tax credit issue as well. So I don't think there's one easy answer. I think the tax credit serves anybody who's working, who's got child care costs and meets the income eligibility, can take advantage of that credit. ERDC, unless we, you know, came up with a whole lot of money, is really only going to serve a very narrow set of individuals. So I think you need both. I actually appreciate the thought of trying to blend it. I'll think on that some more. But they're really meeting different population needs, and they're both important. And some places are complementary depending on the family. So it really is kind of all over the map. But some families will use the credit because that's all they have. And some will have the program and maybe not even file taxes, which would be silly, but they might. So you have a whole range of issues there. So.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Kinigair, yep. And Representative Hayden, the only thing I would say as a member of the Tax Credit Committee is simplifying the number of tax credits we have. We are yes. always looking forward to doing that. Yes. So we'll take that under advisement. So thank
yeah.
you.
We may be working on that, as you can see.
Yeah. So. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's good to see you all.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So I will call up the next three, actually probably four, because these two come together. Bobby Weber, Eva Repito, Sarah Crozier, and Sabi Velasco. Four, because the last two of you are from the same organization. And I have to say that I'm honored to see Bobby Weber here because everything that I learned about childcare started with her about 10 years ago when we worked on a project together. So it's fun to see you here.
It's a great honor for me to be here. Everybody's coming up.
Yeah.
We need one more chair.
Yeah, and then.
Which direction should we go?
And we're hoping that you can each keep it to 3 minutes just because we've got so many people testifying and. We were hoping to do this in an hour total.
Go. Hi. Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Bobby Weber. I'm a researcher at Oregon State University. This my testimony is from my research. It's not a position of OSU. So, but it flows from research we've been doing since the early 2000s on this program. And so I'll do it really fast, and if you want any details, I have I'd be happy to supply you with details. But I want to hit them individually. Protection of the subsidy for a year. We, in the early 2000s, Oregon had the misfortune of being the least stable child care in all the states that were studied. And the changes have been made over time, but it is a problem for both children and parents. So the children need the attachment and the development, and the research shows that when a parent loses the subsidy, the child loses that arrangement. So every time we see a family falling off, think about a child who just got bumped from a caregiver and has gone to some other setting if they lost the subsidy program, our research shows that they
that it's not a pretty picture when they lose the subsidy. They start making arrangements with anybody who will take the child for here and there. So the and for parents, there's plenty of research showing stable subsidy use is highly associated with more stable employment. So stability for the family in both ways. I think the interesting, I want to follow up on the question of whether we'll be bringing more people on by stabilizing them for longer. Our studies show that two-thirds of parents return to employment after 2 quarters, and over 40% return after 1 quarter. So we're losing parents for two reasons predominantly. One, the research shows we lose them first because the policies are leading to disruption. They don't get all their paperwork done and they get kicked off. Or the other major predictor of losing a subsidy is employment loss. That's not necessarily a job change. What the low-wage workers, what hours go up and down, up and down. They go below eligibility and they're off the program. So job instability and our policies have been leading people to leave the program. But in reality, many of them come back. About half who leave come back. And they come back because they get employment again. So it's not so much that we would be providing a much better service to the people we're serving. And so it's the numbers. So when you think about the numbers, it's not what we have now is people coming back. But every time they leave, there's a loss to the child and there's a loss to the parent. Then receipt for coursework. Oregon's one of only 4 states that doesn't already allow this. We're a real outlier. And I just want to affirm the two-generational approach. If we want people to move out of poverty, we don't want them to just stay in these low-wage jobs, which our research shows that our parents are not moving out of these low-wage wage positions, that we follow them over time longitudinally, and they are staying in low-wage jobs. So if we want them to move off taking a two-generational approach in which the investment is in the parent and the child, and this is a very low-hanging fruit, I guess is one way to say it. This is an easy way to do it. We've already got their child. Let's just make sure that the investment in the parent is also being made. Self-employment, I want to tell you a little story. We did Ellen Scott at University of Oregon interviewed parents on the subsidy program. And there was a mom, and she had come off of welfare and had started a house cleaning business. And she was so proud. She'd gotten a grant and gotten the van, and she'd been quite successful and built up quite a business. And the subsidy was paying for her child care. And that was at our first interview. It was a great everything success story. So we did follow-up interviews, and it was while and in between is when we took self-employed people off the subsidy program. So we went back, and the story is very sad. Her oldest child, she said she would never leave at home, but she was, because she had had an ex-boyfriend who was stalking her, she was leaving that child alone. She had younger children who were going from one friend to another, but because they weren't reliable, she was turning down jobs and she was about ready to lose her business. And it was because of the loss of the subsidy. So the quality of care, there are numerous ways we could talk about quality, but our research shows that just the level of generosity, meaning lower co-pays, higher payment rates, better eligibility period, are show increase in use of center care by the subsidy recipients. So we interpret that to mean that when the system allows it, parents choose the kind of care that they believe is best for their child. It doesn't have to be center care, but center care, especially for 3- and 4-year-olds, is a highly desirable thing for almost every parent in America. And unless the subsidy program is running adequately, they really do not have that option on the ERDC program. So these policy changes are essential for us as a community and for as well as for the individual children and families we serve. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Let's get through the panel at least, I think. Eva.
Chair Kitty Geyer and members of the committee, thank you again for opportunity to continue a conversation about child care and having access to it. Today I have with me...
Your name for the record?
Oh, sorry, Eva Ripito, AFSCME, Council 75, and today I'm with two child care providers, certified family child care providers, Sarah, who has a 5-star program, and Sabi, who is working on getting her 3-star. And then Autumn David couldn't be here, but she has a 5-star program, and Shelby Shaw has a 4-star program, and so I'll be submitting written testimony on their behalf. AFSCME is very supportive of this. I participated in the group that Speaker Kotek put together. And we're particularly excited about 6 areas, 2 of which aren't currently in the bill, but will be added through amendments. The 1-year protected eligibility, restoration of self-employed parents, expanding eligibility, incentives for linking ERDC to QRS, so employment-related daycare to the quality rating and improvement system, embedding the goal of employment-related daycare program to meet the federal recommendation of income eligibility and market access, and making eligibility of the program at exit level at 250% of poverty level. If Autumn were here, she would talk about the restoration of the access for self-employed parents. For that, all of our providers are self-employed too, and a lot of them can access or are eligible for the programs too. So they really understand how this hand up will help parents build better businesses and move off the program. For students, a lot of our providers know that their parents that they provide services to, if they were able to finish school a little bit faster, they'd be able to get off the program faster, and then even maybe focus on being able to be closed a day and do their own professional development. I've had a couple of different providers tell me that. And in Shelby Shaw's written testimony, she is an example of someone who did receive public assistance, although it wasn't ERDC. It was another program. But she was able to, as a single parent, have access to child care while she went to school, and now she's a business owner and employer of 3 people in Roseburg. So she's a success story. For the incentives, doing the quality rating and improvement system is you're doing professional development, and the providers are already not getting paid like they should. They are professionals, and they need to be rewarded for their hard work and the work of their assistants if they have them. So I think we should look at ways to do that, and having just that permissible language is great. And then, of course, all the other things too. But I'll let Sarah and Sabi talk more specifically about what they want to highlight. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions too. Okay.
Which one of you wants to start?
Me first.
Sarah?
Okay. Sure. So I can get closer. Okay, no problem.
So state your name for the record.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer. My name is Sarah Crozier. I'm a certified family child care provider in Newburg, Oregon. I've been in business for 7.5 years. I taught kindergarten and first grade for 10 years prior to that. My child care program is called Mi Escuelita Bilingual Preschool and Child Care, and it's 5-star rated. Both my infant program and our preschool program are both 5-star rated. I'm also a member of the AFSCME Local 132 for child care providers. For me, the most important part of this employment-related daycare is making sure that speakers of all the languages, that every child has access to high-quality care. In our case, it's Spanish speakers. I can say right now, every single person that uses EDRC in our program speaks Spanish as their first language. And the proposed changes in House Bill 2015 would not only help these parents, but would help us as providers. Really, for us, it's the one-year eligibility and the goal of the federal recommendation for reimbursement and the incentives that link that QRS to the EDRC that would be helpful. The one-year eligibility will provide stability for children. Every day, parents bring their children to us. We, as providers, count on these positions. I have an enormous waiting list for our program, so when a parent waits on a waiting list, I've had them get on our waiting list. They're on EDRC. They wait for 6 to 8 months to get into our program. And then they get into our program, and one particular family, she was laid off after they'd been with us for almost a year. She got laid off, and she found another job within 3 weeks, literally 3 weeks. But because they have to recertify every month, she lost her position in our program. They lost her benefits. It was a disaster. The child missed the last 2 weeks of our, you know, highly engaged preschool program that prepares them for kindergarten. He missed April and May, which are really super important times to get ready for that kindergarten year. We know that children in poverty have trouble building long-term relationships because they're shuffled from place to place and caregiver to caregiver. This child was just kind of shuffled around while they were trying to figure out what she was going to do. And many times the providers are the ones who say, well, okay, well, just don't pay us. We'll be okay. We qualify in poverty level for a lot of times because we do these things like, okay, don't pay your copay. Okay, don't, you know, we'll try and help you as best as we can because we see the impact daily on these children and their families. For my program, we haven't raised our rates in 4 years because we know that parents can afford it, and we really, really believe in quality care, and we believe that every child, regardless of their language or their socioeconomic status, needs to have access to the quality that we can provide, not just the lucky ones that can get into those great programs, but every child. So I encourage you to pass House Bill 2015 and also to continue this conversation on how you can really support these families through the child care system. And any questions would be fine.
Thank you. Chair Kinger.
Yes.
Can you just explain the rating system to me briefly?
Yeah, as brief as I can. So it's not an obligatory system. All of us that are registered or certified, so once you're licensed, you're able to participate in the Quality Rating and Improvement System, QRIS. So you start by just the baseline. You say, I'm committed to quality. That's a 2-star. You go to classes. You say, I want to improve. From there, each star level, 3, 4, 5, has a tiered amount of things you have to do. If you're interested, you're more than welcome to come out to my program, and I can show you the portfolios, and I can walk you through it all. I've had other members of the legislature have come out before in different committees. It's a lot of work. So I have 6 staff members that we employ, plus 3 teenagers that work for me through work study through the local high school. And they all have to meet large amounts of professional development. Things that we have in our program have to meet what we know are quality programs. A 5-star means that's the highest, and it's a lot of work, I'll tell you. Months and months and months of every night, hours and hours. My husband, our children would go to bed at 7, and we would work till 11 or 12 o'clock at night working on our portfolios outside of the classes and time it takes to go and get all the professional development. So when we say a provider is a 3-star or a 4-star or a 5-star, it means that provider, outside of the quality that they provide in their program, is spending hours of their own time bettering themselves, bettering their program, and putting that together and sending it off to Western Oregon, where they evaluate those. And then we're also where people come out and evaluate us on some different measures to make sure that we're truly meeting what we say we're doing. So it's a lot of checks and balances involved.
Thank you. We can also get that information to you.
And there's an entire website dedicated to it. Is
it? Can you give me that link?
Okay. Buenas tardes, estimada Chair Kenny Geyer y miembros del comité.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee.
Mi nombre es Abby Velasco y soy proveedor certificado. en el cuidado infantil en el área de Aloha y Viverto. He estado haciendo esto durante 7 años y mi programa de cuidado infantil ahorita es C2Q, en proceso para calificar a Estrella 3 en el programa del QRIS. Yo también soy miembro electo y líder de ASMI Local 132 y proveedoras del cuidado infantil.
My name is Savi Velasco. I am a certified family child care provider in the Aloha Beaverton area. I have been in business for 7 years. My child care program is C2Q, in process to receive my 3-star ranking in the quality rating and improvement system. I'm also a member and elected leader of ASME Local 132 Child Care Providers.
Gracias por la oportunidad de testificar en apoyo de las expansiones para el ERDC. Estoy muy emocionada con todas las propuestas, pero quisiera destacar en el implantar elegibilidad protegida para un año con el fin de mantener la continuidad de la atención y ofrecer una mayor seguridad a las familias trabajadoras de bajos ingresos atendidos por ERDC. Un cambio en los ingresos o las horas de trabajo no obligaría a una familia para interrumpir un arreglo de cuidado infantil existente durante el periodo de un año. Sea aún necesario familias reportar un cambio de proveedor o de cuidado infantil durante ese mismo periodo. Es una excelente propuesta.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the expansions for employment-related daycare. I'm excited by all the proposals and I know the bill, but I would like to highlight one. Implementing 1-year protected eligibility in order to maintain continuity of care and provide greater security for low-income working families served by ERDC. A change in income or working hours would not force a family to interrupt an arrangement of existing child care during a period of 1 year. Families would still be required to report a change in child care provider during that period. It is an excellent proposal.
¿Por qué es importante para mí esto? Porque muchos niños serán beneficiados junto con sus familias, ya que es importante para la educación y seguridad de nuestros niños, ya que ellos son el futuro de nuestro país. ¿Por qué es importante para las familias que se preocupan, ya que cuando los descansa de un trabajo o tienen un nuevo trabajo o tienen esa transición económica estable y no están temiendo que se les va a quitar la ayuda de ERDC? Porque de esa manera evitamos que los niños vayan a lugares con una calidad de cuidado pobre, y con esta propuesta los más favorecidos son los niños.
Why is this important for me? It is important because many children would benefit together with their families, as it is important for the education and safety of our children, and they are the future of our country. Why is it important for families? When they get laid off from a job or get a new job, they will have an economically stable transition, and they won't be concerned that they're going to be removed from ERDC while they find new work. This way, we avoid children being placed with a poor quality care provider, and children are those who will most benefit from this proposal.
Yo apoyo este House of Bill 2015 y gracias por su tiempo. Doy la bienvenida a cualquier pregunta.
I urge your support for House Bill 2015. Thank you for your time. I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Gracias. Any questions for the panel?
Sure. Go. Señora Velasco, sí, gracias por estar aquí con nosotros. Su trabajo es muy importante para todas las familias. Gracias.
Gracias.
Sí, sí.
A general question. Is it a requirement that child care providers in Oregon have union representation?
Hay un requisito que los proveedores de cuidado
infantil. I didn't hear the question.
Is it a requirement?
I just didn't hear the question. I'm sorry. Is it a requirement that they have what?
Union representation.
Chair Kinigaya, Representative Bueller, no, it is not a requirement that child care providers have union representation. It's completely voluntary.
And you might say AFSCME represents licensed?
Yes.
And SEIU represents the unlicensed providers.
Stacy can, right, hear, and she can tell you more. So we let, Chair, Kenny Geyer and represent Wheeler. We do represent the licensed in-home providers, and there are two levels of licensure for in-home family child care, registered and certified. And they are they have different training requirements and have different levels of numbers of children that they can care for. Registered is up to 10. And then certified providers can care for
up to 16.
Up to 12 to 16, depending on when they received their certification. So,
thank you.
One quick.
Representative
Chair Kenny Gaia, thank you. You talked about the certificate at the star rating being many, many hours late at night. The industry as a whole, does it generally support that process, or do they find it overburdensome, too much, too little, about right?
Okay. The thing is, we're all independent business owners, so we will work at it. Mostly, I've felt like everyone really attains to that. Like, we want to show that we're improving our quality. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there will always be those who will say, I don't really want to put in that work, or it's not really. But the majority are making some plans. I know, like, the C2Q, if you go on, that's the commitment to quality, which is the first level. If you put your zip code in, you'll see many, many, many providers, which means I'm making this commitment. Now, it may take me a year or two, depending on my life circumstances, to get there. Or you may make the goal as a family that we're going to do it now. But I think that it's very well received.
Okay.
¿Entendiste la pregunta?
Sí.
Okay. ¿Quieres responder algo?
No, está bien.
So, and for clarification, the ERDC subsidies did not used to reflect any difference because of differences in quality. This was the first time with the institution of this rating system that we can attach a greater subsidy to a higher level of quality. Is that correct? Representative Parrish.
You mentioned, and I'm sorry, help me with your name again.
Sarah.
Okay. You mentioned you have 6 employees and a few others who are
3. Mm-hmm, and 3, plus my husband and myself.
Okay. So there are, not in this committee, but there are quite a few employer-related mandates that are coming forward this year. Increase in minimum wage, sick pay, retirement. Can you tell me what that does to your business if you're already struggling with people who are making their co-pays, but now you're going to have to raise your rates to accommodate that. Can you talk about...
And if you can keep that brief only because we have so many more. I know it's a very important question. It's not completely related to ERDC, so just if you can keep it brief so we can get to the others.
So it's that struggle between moral issue and I want my families to receive more money, and I would gladly pay my teachers $15 or $20 an hour if I could, but the reality of what we receive back as child care providers doesn't match that as well. I would encourage that if we decided to go that way as a state, that there be a youth concept like other states have. Paying a high schooler $15 an hour to come to my program for 2 or 3 hours a day to get job experience would be excruciating, and I wouldn't probably have them there. And that's how I started. I was 15 when I got my first job in a child care center, knowing I wanted to work with children, going on to get my bachelor's degree and then my master's degree and doing all that. I knew that's what I wanted to do, but it started at 14, 15. And I think our children would lose that opportunity. I think as adults, we would figure out the adult side of it. We would work out the economics, all of it as a business owner. But as that youth side, I would hope that it would be manageable to get the young people in the industry. And child care, we need those kids at 15, 16 to fall in love with this, to fall in love with kids. So, and the rest, I hope.
Okay, thank you. And I do appreciate that. And Chair Kenny, while we're not going to hear those in our committee, I think that a lot of the proposals that we are hearing are going to be kind of hinged on some of those other pieces of legislation, because if we make one change to somewhere in the system, it's going to have impacts across the system. And if these bills don't reflect or match whatever those final outcomes are, I think you're going to suddenly create a lot
of... Very
clips.
Fair question. I just want to make sure people who came to talk about ERDC get that opportunity. So, yeah. Thank you. And we will call up now Sarah Lenstein, Stacy Cowan, Marilee Haas. Stacy, why don't you start us off?
Sure.
Chair Kinigeyer, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan, I'm with the SEIU Local 503. As it was mentioned before, we represent licensed exempt providers, sometimes referred to as friends, family, neighbor providers. I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 2015 and the entire package that the speaker spoke about and some of the other folks spoke about. I recognize this is the policy bill, but I will speak a little bit broader to some of the other investments. We were really happy to be able to participate in the committee that led up to the recommendations in this bill, so we just want to say thank you for that opportunity. And actually, we had planned to have a provider here today, but those folks that are involved in child care recognize late last night I received an email that the child that our provider cares for came down ill, so he had to stay home with the provider. So I was hoping to be able to share his story a little bit today and just kind of speak to that, and I'll keep it brief. So Larry Caird has been a child care provider and an SEIU member for 5 years. He cares for his two granddaughters, as well as a high school student with special needs. His daughter works at the University of Oregon. Her job at the university does offer her advancement opportunities that will eventually allow her to work herself out of the program in the near future. But both Larry and his daughter would let you know that without this program, she would have been hard-pressed to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. A few years ago, she was an unemployed single mother trying to make it in a tough economy. Today, she's employed in a job with a future that allows her to provide for her children. And she was able to do this with the security of knowing that her child was receiving quality care with someone that she trusts very much. So House Bill 2015 and the investments that Speaker Kotek has proposed will absolutely help strengthen the ERDC program. I think folks have spoken to that. The other piece that we really want to talk about, too, is the existing need that's out there. And we appreciate the comments that were made about balancing the program improvements along with expanding. And it really is a really delicate balance because, again, you want the highest quality program, but you also want families to be able to access it. Currently, there are nearly 1,700 families that are on the reservation list. These were numbers that were just released by DHS the other day. So, again, we just want to stress that we really would like to see the program expanded. I know that, obviously, numbers need to be crunched, and the more investments that you made, it's finding that balance. But we just want to recognize that of those 1,700 families, I imagine that represents a large number of families that didn't bother to get on the reservation list. There's a tremendous need that we want to make sure that those families are being served. And we all know this, I'm sure folks have read, but the sad truth is that child care costs are rising faster than family incomes. Child care is a critical support for working families. When parents can't get access to affordable care, they can't maintain employment, and that leads to that instability that's been talked about. When families become less economically stable, they risk entering the system in other ways, through TANF, through other programs that the state offers, through the child welfare system in some really worst-case scenarios. So House Bill 2015 will help strengthen the ERDC program by increasing stability for families and helping to support positive child development. Quality child care helps prepare children to succeed in school by providing safe, supportive, and a stimulating learning environment. If families can't afford quality child care, many parents must consider less suitable alternatives, and Bobby Weber spoke to that. We know that families, if they are able to keep their employment, they still piece together child care, and it's sad to think about sometimes what that may be. They may not be making the best choice possible if they had other alternatives. So we look very much forward to working with the department on developing and implementing additional opportunities for licensed exempt providers around professional development and really supporting the work that they do and helping to provide the highest quality of care possible. So with that, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Representative Kinigeyer and members of the committee, my name is Marilee Haas, and I'm executive director of the Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children, and we're a statewide professional organization of people that work within the early childhood field. Some of our members are family child care providers or center staff or center directors. Some also work in Head Start, early intervention. Some are working for colleges and universities, preparing our future workforce. And some are kindergarten and primary school teachers. And we are committed to the well-being of young children and the ongoing professional development of our members. And with that, OAYC is supportive of House Bill 2015 for the enhancement and the expansion of the employment-related daycare program. It provides critical support for low-income working families so that they can have the dignity of work to support their family. And it provides basic safety standards for all programs, and for licensed care, additional standards and training requirements. Parents choose the type of care they use for several reasons. It can be based on their work hours, their cultural values, the ability of the program to serve all their child care needs, such as having siblings together or having a child that has a special need that does not do well in a larger setting. They also need access to transportation to access that child care, as well as looking at what it's going to cost them out of their own pocket, their copay. By allowing the parent to have a lower copay for higher quality programs, it provides a further option for the family in making those choices. And by allowing for enhanced reimbursement rates for the higher tiered programs, as you've heard in earlier testimony, you'd help to provide funds to maintain that higher quality of care, the additional training hours that are required. Further, the extension of the one-year eligibility, as you've heard, will create that stability for the child, for the parent, and for the child care provider. It also has the benefit of relieving some of the constant monitoring that DHS staff has to do to be sure that redetermination, instead they would just be reported the current work status of that family. And it will help child care providers and child care centers plan for consistency in their enrollment. Many programs want to know that how many children are starting in September and that they will continue through that school year. And stability in family income for the child care providers that are self-employed and for the center staff that are dependent on having enough work hours themselves in these programs. So I thank you for your consideration of the bill.
Thank you.
Quick question. Mueller? Is there any mandatory training of child care workers to prevent child sexual abuse?
Yes, there is. There, Representative Bueller and members of the committee, there is a required recognizing and reporting child abuse and neglect that is required for all child care providers to take.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our last panel, Kate Newhall, Jane Sparta, and Megan Moyer. Did I miss somebody? Oh, Dana Hepper, why don't you come up at the same time? And talk fast. We want to hear everything you have to say, but talk fast.
Chair Kennegaier, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with Portland Community College, and I will be brief in speaking in support specifically of adding covering coursework in relation to employment-related daycare. PCC has over 90,000 students, and we're proud to say that we are opportunity for all. But we serve students in a lot of different places in their lives. We have students coming out of high school, and we have people changing courses, and we serve people headed toward bachelor's degrees, we have people headed toward certificates, and we have people attaining some basic and remedial skills, and we want to make sure that they're able to do that regardless of the challenges that families can provide. And we know from our own experience at PCC, we do offer child care facilities on several of our campuses. They're always full. They cannot operate all the hours that a family needs, and we often find our own student activity fees. Student leadership has actually dedicated money to helping their fellow students with child care because it is such a need, and it can be such a barrier to retention and completion. And so we are excited about this proposal. We look forward to participating in the rulemaking process to make sure that it captures all of our students, because we know how important an education can be to lifting a family out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. And we're really grateful that that is being looked at in this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. James?
I'll go next. My name is James Barta. I am the new legislative director for Children First of Oregon. And thank you for your time, committee. At Children First, we want to make Oregon the very best place that can be to be a kid. And on this point, let me make two broad points, that this bill, as you can see, has broad support. In addition to the people testifying, I believe you also have a letter of support from about seven different organizations, several of whom have not been represented up here, so we are keeping it down, but surprisingly. And there's always other groups, you know, that are stepping forward, and we're looking forward to building this coalition further. Now, I think the second broad point, instead of going through the details, is it's a really a question of, do we want a quality program? And that's what these changes are talking about. We have an important program that serves many people and not enough, but to serve them effectively, we need a quality program that doesn't make them fill out paperwork every month, that allows them to further their education and allows them to have work experience to make a better workforce. So I think that's the question we're asking ourselves here, and it's very important to have a quality program to help these young parents advance in the workforce.
Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall with Family Forward Oregon, and I will try and make my comments very brief. We're happy to be here today in support of House Bill 2015 and all of the enhancements to ERDC that it makes. We believe that these changes make ERDC a more robust program that actually works better for the families that it's serving. I think having access to affordable child care helps parents stay employed, and it helps their children stay in quality child care arrangements. We certainly support and want to echo the comments of everybody else, the one-year eligibility determinations. We think that that creates much more stability for the children and for the families that are utilizing ERDC. We also have been long supportive of the change to allow ERDC to also allow working parents who are also in school use the vouchers for school time. I think everybody knows that those with higher education ultimately have a better chance at a higher paying job and eventually moving off the program. So we think that that class time really is very important, and it's something that if somebody is taking the time to do post-secondary education or other job training, that should be recognized and credited. We also like the voluntary incentives to have families choose quality child care providers. I think one of the things that I've said before this committee is that affordability shouldn't be the only consideration when you're looking for a child care provider. And I think with that, one last thing. I think our state investments in child care should accomplish three goals. They should support good long-term outcomes for our kids. They should support the parents who require child care to maintain their jobs. And they should help ensure that the people, who are mostly women, providing child care earn a decent living wage. For these reasons, Family Forward supports House Bill 2015 and the ERDC enhancements. We also support allocating sufficient resources to eliminate the waiting list. I think I'll say this again. We don't even know how many potential families there are out there. We know that there's a waiting list of nearly 1,700 families right now. I don't know if I were potentially eligible if I would make the step to get on that waiting list knowing that it was so long. So I would say beyond just eliminating the waiting list, I think making sure it serves every family that is actually eligible. So with that, thank you.
Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute. Our mission is to move research into action by supporting public and private investments in our youngest children, birth to age 8, some would say prenatal. And I just want to look at this policy through the lens of child brain development, because a lot of children who are in child care under ERDC are age birth to age 5. And so with that lens, there are two provisions that stand out to me as critically important. In Section 1, it talks about that one-year eligibility, which you've heard quite a bit about. When young children are in this critical period of brain development, disruption of surroundings, routines, and relationships with caregivers are actually detrimental to their healthy cognitive development and can have long-term negative impacts. So providing that one-year consistency actually helps us get to those school readiness, third grade reading goals. So we think that's a really important piece. And then Section 4 speaks to those incentives for selecting quality childcare. And again, these high-quality early care and education environments pay off down the road in terms of on-track child development and school readiness outcomes in a way that we think is worth investing in and has a long-term payoff. So thanks for considering the legislation.
That's great. Thank you, Dan. And I'm sorry I mispronounced your name.
That's okay. I'm used to it.
I am hoping none of you have questions. And I know I talked about Rhonda coming up, but I'm thinking that we should hold that. Rhonda, I think you heard the question about how do you employ, how do you determine self-employment? What are the either hours or income, or how do you do that? So if you could get that to us, if any of the rest of you have questions, please let me know, and we will let Rhonda know so you can get back to us. That's great. I want to make sure that we have enough time for Margaret Van Fleet. We are going to close the public hearing on 2015 and open the informational session on Oregon Housing and Community Services. And for those of you who missed our first meeting when we talked about scheduling, we are aiming to take off every other Friday because of some people who live quite far from here, and we had the 3 to 4:45 time slot. And as a result, we are adding 15 minutes, so we are going till 5 every Monday, Wednesday. So we have almost the time we allotted for
you. Okay, very good.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. What I'd like to do today, and I'll be as efficient as I can, is give you a very high-level overview of housing as an issue in Oregon as we see it at my department, and then also provide a high-level overview of the agency and kind of its work in that environment, recognizing that we can come back and cover things in more depth as session goes on, or if any of you would like to meet with me individually, I'll certainly make myself available to do that. So we do have a PowerPoint that is not it's showing to me. So she'll get this teed up here. There we go. Again, on sort of the very high-level overview on housing, the issue. Some of you are familiar with this world. And others maybe not so much. So in our the industry, if you will, we talk about housing across a continuum. And generally speaking, that continuum starts with homelessness, extends through rental housing, and then on up through homeownership. So there's these different segments of the affordable housing industry, and they're really managed in really pretty different ways. And I'll touch a little bit on that, but at a pretty high level. On the homeless side, whether you're talking about people who have been chronically homeless, people who are situationally homeless, those programs tend to be managed in a very localized manner with nonprofits and big networks of social service providers at the local level. In the middle, the rental housing is for people who aren't sort of in crisis, if you will, and that's the part of the industry that really interacts much more with the real estate industry generally, and we have any number of actors in both the public and private sector who provide a range of different kinds of housing, and you'll hear terms like permanent supportive housing or public housing, and those are parts of the market that interact with really the private sector in the broader rental arena. And then the other sort of the top end of the affordable housing arena is, of course, home ownership. We talk of that in terms of policy agendas at the national and state levels as ways to build pathways for wealth creation and asset building. We've spent a lot of time in recent years talking about foreclosure avoidance so people can retain their home ownership. The term affordable gets tossed around a lot, and sometimes it's helpful to just ground folks in what that means. What we mean when we talk about affordable housing and what the feds and HUD means is that in general, folks shouldn't have to pay more than 30% of their income towards rent, and that's so that folks can have money left over to pay for other things. Of course, that makes sense. But that 30% standard is a national standard that we've adopted. States
states have adopted. It's kind of the way we manage programs against that standard. Sometimes folks debate it, but it hasn't changed in many, many years. Another statistic which we think is interesting and a little bit alarming is one that comes to us from a group called the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And as you can see here, they've determined that someone earning minimum wage in our state would have to work 72 hours to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment at the average rents in Oregon. Average rents in Oregon used for this calculation are just about $850 a month. And that would be what it would take economically to keep them at that 30% level. Not surprisingly, we're not meeting that standard for many, many Oregonians. In fact, nearly one in three Oregonians pay more than half their income towards rent, and one in two pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. Excuse me. More than half and one in two. Those seem like the same. So sorry about that. One of the ways we look at this is we look at how many households in our state are considered extremely low income. That means that they earn less than 30% of the area median income for their county. Just by way of example, I looked up a couple of counties. In Josephine County, a family of three would be considered extremely low income if they earned $13,650 a year. In Salem, the number is just over $15,000 a year. So these are very poor households, and there's 175,000 of them in Oregon. And the troubling part of the math is there's just a fraction of the apartments on the market are affordable for folks at that income level. Another statistic we tend to keep track of is how many school children in our public schools in Oregon are considered homeless by the school's definition. That number actually went up this last year. All these numbers are continuing at pretty high levels. The trends have not abated. So that's just an indicator of sort of need and stress and the number of families who are probably pretty stressed. Geographically, you can see...
Margaret, can I stop you
yes,
for
of
one
course.
Minute there? So we've been hearing in this committee and others that we're coming out of the recession.
Yes.
Wages are starting to go up. People yes. are getting more. And yet homelessness is on the rise. So
correct.
So I think there's a couple of pieces. That the affordable housing, the housing prices are going higher and
right.
higher up. And pricing people out of the market.
That's yes, Chair Kennegar. I think that's the basic answer. That while the recovery is uneven, I think you probably know that as well. And that the low wage workers are being reemployed, but the wages are not increasing as fast as rents and real estate prices generally are increasing. So that gap, from what we can see, is in fact growing. Mm-hmm. Now the private market may catch up in terms of building more units, but there's naturally going to be a lag with what the private sector does. The sort of headline I would say for this map of the state is the darker the spots, those are by census tract and obviously groupings of census tracts, the worse off you have in terms of number of households who are rent burdened. And so we watch that and try and think about ways we can direct our programs and prioritize investments, all of which are very scarce in my department, to the places where they're the greatest need so that we can really drive toward lessening the severity of the rent burden for folks. And then the next piece of good news here is another sort of look at the need. This is a slide that can be a little bit confusing. On the left, the couple of bars, the lighter blue is how much income you need to afford a one-bedroom apartment or a two-bedroom apartment, and this is for the Salem metropolitan area. And then that is compared to the darker bars for what are the wages for typical job families, if you will. And so while in some places, it's not so far off, you can see that many lower wage jobs, things like janitor, home health aide, child care worker, as we just discussed, they're pretty close to that bar. And so these are just, I'm just kind of giving you a window into different ways you can measure need and how we want to be thinking about policy. We're at the agency trying to be much more intentional about thinking about how do we measure need? How do we think about prioritization when we're operating in an environment with scarce resources? So that's a high-level overview and not a lot of trend there, but we can go deeper another day if that's of interest to the committee. I'll shift now to a quick overview of the department, the Housing and Community Services Department. Our origins go back to the early 70s when we were part of the what was then the Department of Commerce. We were a freestanding agency in the mid-1980s. There are agencies like mine all over the country. They're known as housing finance agencies, or HFAs. And generally speaking, all of us who are HFAs have the ability to issue federal tax-exempt bonds, to allocate and administer federal low-income housing tax credits, and award various other HUD grants. That's a common sort of structure for HFAs. In 1991, we became Housing and Community Services when what was then the Community Services Division of the Department of Human Resources was transferred from that agency into mine. And so we gained new programs at that time, and HUD and the feds have continued to give us additional programs as well. So we administer a particular flavor, if you will, of HUD Section 8 contracts. We were the recipient of $220 million of federal hardest-hit funds from U.S. Department of Treasury to address the foreclosure crisis, and the legislature has granted us a variety of other tools as well. So we've been around for that many decades, and the charge has continued to evolve. So 2 years ago, I was in front of this committee, and some of you know this story pretty well, so I'll be brief. But we did, suffice to say, a very thorough examination of our agency, from governance and how do we set policy, to kind of our fiscal model, our business model, how do we pay for things and how cost-effective is that, what's our service delivery kind of map or methodology, and what is the nature of our community partnerships. We did a deep dive that was grounded in a lot of analytics and a lot of community engagement with all of our stakeholder partners. We all, I would say, learned a lot about the agency. And there was a point at which the question on the table was actually, should this agency continue to exist, or should we take its programs and tuck them into other agencies and abolish, effectively, one state agency? So we wrestled with that and talked about and debated that at great length. The result was, we said to the legislature and to the governor, we don't think that's the right answer. We think there's a lot we can do to refocus and redesign the agency to be more effective and to be more fiscally sustainable over the long term. And so that's the path we're on right now, is to finish the redesign work that we started through all of these analytics. And so you can see the four kind of major emphases for that redesign. We want to think differently about our role and be much more of a facilitator and de-emphasize, although not get away with, do away with completely our kind of regulatory function, but balance that a little bit more with being more of a facilitator. We want to think differently about policy and governance, and you'll be hearing a bill later this week that deals with that. We want to think differently about using data and drive mutual accountability both for us and for our contractors who do service delivery on our behalf. And then we really need to take seriously the idea that we have to work in partnership with our sister state agencies and align our work in state government. That's a multi-year effort, and we are well on our way to achieving that. As part of that effort, we refreshed, I would say. We didn't radically change, but we did refresh our vision and mission for the agency. You can see them articulated here. We think our job is to provide stable and affordable housing and engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for all Oregonians. So we see ourselves as having the job of doing the housing, but in service to a bigger agenda, and I think it's important that we articulate that for ourselves and for our partners and our employees. One of the goals, these are kind of intertwined goals that came out of our redesign process and the many, many conversations we had with our partners and employees. These goals around both positioning the state to achieve economic security for people by strengthening the housing system and integrating our work and our policy outcomes, but also with what we've got to serve greater numbers of Oregonians, low-income Oregonians, more effectively within the housing system. So we see it's both, that we've got to drive more improvement in outcomes within the system, but do that in a way that's supportive of the other systems. It turns out we aren't the only ones in the country who think deeply about housing and why it matters. And so this slide gives you a glimpse into some of the national work and conversations that are happening, that people like organizations like the MacArthur Foundation are studying, have an initiative called How Housing Matters. And they publish papers now and again, and there was one that struck us as quite relevant for Oregon that has to do with the impact that stable housing has on children in school. It's not a surprise, but to have an academic and foundation-based study sort of document that, we thought was relevant and interesting. Similarly, healthcare, not a surprise, but if you have stable housing, your health outcomes are much more likely to be positive. And the interface with public safety has also been studied nationally. And this idea that people, when they come out of prisons, they're much less likely to repeat any offenses and to be more productive members of society if they've got stable housing, among other things. So we feel like that's part of kind of that drives us towards this bigger view of our role in state government. We also sort of came up with this graphic, if you will, to really define and articulate how we see ourselves, that if we can get that housing foundation right, both kind of as a state agency and the bureaucracy, if you will, that we're charged with running, that if we can do that really well, that we can actually provide substantial support to these other public policy outcomes. And we take that charge very seriously. We're not there yet. We still have a lot of work to do. But this is sort of our way of thinking about who we are and why we exist. So a look at the sort of continuum of programs my agency runs. They start with homelessness prevention, ending and preventing folks' homelessness, providing energy assistance to low-income people, weatherizing the homes of low-income people. We provide a variety of tools to help the development of rental housing, and we promote homeownership access through down payment assistance and a first-time mortgage product, and also homeownership retention through a variety of foreclosure mitigation programs. This graphic, I think, is helpful to illustrate. Don't try and read all the little words. this graphic really attempts to show our role in the housing system, and that is specifically that we are an intermediary. We do not provide direct service. We do not build anything ourselves. We are not anybody's landlord. But we do get a variety of funds from the federal government and quite a variety of state funding sources as well. You can think of our job as packaging those resources and sending them back out the door to community-based partners in the private sector and to some local governments and housing authorities. The other thing to note on this chart is on the far left, the orange piece, rental assistance, and there's a variety of programs that go from HUD, not through us, but directly to local public housing authorities. Sometimes folks think that my agency has some jurisdiction over local housing authorities. We do not. So they get their money directly from HUD. And I would reflect that we have made the housing system very complex, and I wish that was not so, but it is. So that's, again, just a graphic to explain our role in the larger scheme. And then here is the similar chart for the streams of funds that we think of as housing stabilization funds. That's specifically programs like the homelessness, preventing and ending people's homelessness, energy assistance, and weatherization. And those funds funds. Again, you can see lots of sources, both federal and state. Those funds actually go back, almost all go out to community action agencies by grant agreements. And so we work very closely with local community action agencies all over the state. Wanted to flag for the committee the kind of the legislation that is that my agency is working on this session. You're going to hear more about House Bill 2442 on Wednesday, but the headline here is that for many years we've had many statutorily named advisory bodies that tell, that advise about different parts of work and different programs and different streams of funding for the agency. One of the big efforts around our transition planning and redesign is to sort of clean that up, if you will, to streamline, to refresh. And so House Bill 2442 will help us by creating what we're hoping you'll call the Housing Stability Council. It will take the existing Housing Council, State Housing Council duties, refresh them, align them, add some things, and we'll propose to sunset some existing bodies and transfer responsibility for others. Again, we'll talk more about that, I believe, on Wednesday. Three other bills, just to let you know about briefly. One is the extension and renewal of the IDA program, which is a well-known and very effective asset-building initiative. You'll be hearing about that this session. Senate Bill 244, I would characterize almost as House cleaning. There are some things about the way our programs are structured that we uncovered during our transition planning that we think could be administered more effectively and easily for our partners to use. And so some of that lives in statute, and so we would propose to clean that up. We don't think there's any controversy about any of that, but we'll let the process work, do its work. And then this is not our bill, Senate Bill 296. It's a bill that the Department of Revenue is putting forward. We're supportive of the eventual transfer of the Elderly Rental Assistance Program from Department of Revenue to our department. And we think we've got a plan to implement that smoothly. And then finally, wanted to mention the governor's recommended budget. As I think many of you know, proposes $100 million in new funding for housing creation. The goals of this would be to create new rental housing to address that gap in the market that I touched on a few minutes ago. We would do it in a way that would target families with the lowest incomes, really to try and prevent and end family homelessness. The mechanisms proposed in the governor's budget would be $85 million in general fund-backed bonds. These are known as Article 11Q bonds, if you want to check your constitution. And then the other 15 was proposed as lottery-backed bonds. A brief word about this. We've used lottery-backed bonds many times in the past for housing construction and development and preservation. The use of general obligation bonds would be new. And so we know we need to tread very carefully, and we intend to do that with the Council of Bond Experts and Finance folks at State Treasury and DAS and elsewhere. But we're excited about the possibility of bringing that forward and creating new units in Oregon. A couple of things I want to assure this committee about the approach we will use to contemplate the investment of such a substantial amount of funds. One is that we would very much intend to use and partner with the existing community-based development capacity. We would work very hard to make sure that the target families really are well served and that DHS and other resources are, in fact, in place before units come online so that the right families are referred and they are well served by the safety net system. And then I think we are duty bound to think very carefully about leveraging and getting as many units out of any investment. And so we take that very seriously. So that's my very fast flyby. I am happy to take questions, or an hour later.
Questions?
Actually, a comment.
Please.
So Margaret was in my office right before committee, and something came up that in all the conversations about housing, I'd never known before. And I'd asked the question about, you know, people moving in and out of housing, and what Margaret shared with me, and something we might want to consider as a committee. I tend to not be somebody who falls on the everybody scamming the government, but apparently there's no check on the income after people are in our state subsidized housing. We don't go back and evaluate, do you now earn more than what you were when you were eligible? So potentially we do have families who are in these housing units who don't necessarily need to be there, and we've got very long wait lists. So I do think as a committee I'd like to see us evaluate that, and I don't think that, you know, I think maybe with some legislative direction, certainly they can do some of that through administrative rule, but I do think that is something we should consider, because there are families who really are waiting, and there might be some who maybe would not have otherwise qualify based on current income levels right now. And this housing, affordable housing, is so scarce that for me, if we can make sure that we have a process where we are reevaluating income and then maybe successfully transitioning people out of this housing so we can free up that space, you know, it certainly maybe takes some of the pressure on some of the bonding requests and dollars for more affordable housing if we can make sure the people who really need to be there are there. So,
yeah.
New information for me as of today.
I do think there is mechanisms for monitoring that, so it'd be helpful to hear whether there is or not.
Yes, Chair Kangeyer and members of the committee, we'll double check this, but what I think I understand is that most of the programs, and in fact the biggest program, which is the Federal Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program, does require that the owner annually check income and certify sort of eligibility, and they report that to us. What they're not required to do is, if your income goes up, you're not required to move out, even if you become over income for some period of time. Now, there may be a cap on that, which I'll need to check that. So there is a trigger inside the biggest program, but I'm not sure it applies to all the programs. So it's a question I think that we should very much look into, and I'm happy to do that.
How about with Section 8? Or other subsidy programs?
Yeah. So, Chair Kangeyer, the short answer on Section 8 and public housing, which are owned by housing authorities and much more highly regulated, the income is based on, or the rent is based on somebody's income. As it goes up, their rent goes up, which is, you know, a problem in some other ways. But there is that annual check on income very specifically. And then once they get to 80% of area median income, you would have to move out of public housing or Section 8. Those are not programs that we administer, but just as a point of interest. Yeah.
Thanks, Margaret. That's a very nice presentation. Why do you think there is such a mismatch between supply and demand in affordable housing in Oregon?
Chair Kangeyer and Representative Bueller, I wonder about that a lot. I have worked in this field my whole career. And, I think there's... I think it's this gap between wages and rents primarily. And there's any number of things that work to change real estate prices. Most of us actually, get our housing needs met in the private sector. We, own a home or we rent an apartment from a private, owner. And there's a lot of complicated market dynamics at work in the rental market. And our little tools try and sort of mitigate for those around the margins, but it's really on the margins. Mm-hmm. It's the classic supply and demand, and people study it all the time, and there's no one answer.
Do you want to follow up?
Yeah. My concern is, at least from where I come from, it's really hard to solve a problem unless you know the underlying causes. So I think we really need to put some effort into identifying the cause before we really start trying to solve a problem.
Thank you. Yeah, it's point well taken, and we can talk about sort of what are some of the individual causes and what's going on in individual communities. I would say, as I look out across the work we do in different communities across Oregon, the communities look really different. Klamath Falls feels very different from Prineville, feels very different from Portland. And so there are a lot of different dynamics at work in those individual real estate markets. But.
Yeah, point well taken.
And I will just venture to guess that in addition to wages, there's issues like zoning. You had raised the question about land use laws last time. And so I'm sure those are significant factors as well. Representative Taylor?
Thank you. I have a two-part question. One, I was wondering if you could explain in more detail what the homeless child statistic that you presented, the 18,000 approximately, what is that definition of when you use the school-based children? And then the second part is that, and I don't even know if this is necessarily a good public policy, but trying to understand what direction the state provides, if any, to local jurisdictions about how to prioritize that. Now, obviously, you know very well that in certain areas of the state, the number of homeless children is increasing rapidly. I care about it across the whole state. It just happens to be in our, in representative parishes in my districts, we've seen a very significant increase over the last 10 years of homeless children in Clackamas County and then, of course, in Multnomah County. So I was just wondering what that statistic means, who's in that population, and how are funds being prioritized so that children are off the street?
Yeah. So, Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, it's a great question. There is a very precise way that the Department of Education asks local public school districts to count homeless people, homeless children. Broadly, I can tell you that includes families who are literally homeless, who are maybe staying in shelters or that are known to be sleeping outside or camping in their car. It also includes families who are what we call couch surfing, which is a sort of a term that is, you know, what it sounds like. So they're not they're living with grandma, they're living with friends, they got evicted and they're not sleeping outside, but they're staying temporarily, and it's clear that it's a temporary housing situation for the family. And so the school districts have a way, and they have resources that don't come through my agency, to count and have some kind of case management or some resources specifically to pay attention to the issue of homeless kids in schools. So, and the number has gone up. I do know that in the last couple of years. So it's hovering around, as you see, you know, 20,000. So if I can, happy to follow up and get you more specifics about how the school districts do that and kind of what's involved in the count. And your other question was, what direction do we provide to school districts or local governments generally?
Prioritizing funds so that we don't literally have children sleeping on the street.
It's a, So, Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, it's we don't do a great job of it right now, truthfully. So my agency has some of the money, and we do our best to prioritize and tell communities, tell us how great your need is, and tell us how great your solution is going to be. And we put them through a competition, and we pick winners and losers. And I can tell you, for every tax credit or grant we award, there's two others that are just as worthy that I could have. So we do our best. It's an imperfect system. When it comes to specifically serving homeless people, I recently have had reason to dive into this. How does that work? Who gets money? Who controls it? Where does it go? The system is very fragmented. There are literally 19 federal agencies who do something about homelessness across the country and send money through agencies like mine and directly to local governments and other places to address homelessness. My agency, the money that flows through my agency that is a little bit of general fund, a little bit of document recording fee, which we can talk about later, but generally it's about $7 to $10 million a year, so not big, big dollars, is what I send to local communities to deal specifically with homelessness and emergency housing issues. Those same communities get about $25 million directly from the feds, from HUD, to also work on that. So I'm a small player in their solution, but we're trying to be very targeted and intentional. So super complicated system, and I wish I had a different answer for you.
Let me go to here and there. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Margaret, on the definition of homeless, is that a statutory, like, where, I mean, who's determined that somebody who got evicted from the house and is staying now with grandma, that that would classify that child as homeless. Is that a state statute, or is that there's some language in the federal government that has us track kids that way? Because it seems to me that that number feels artificially inflated, and in that I think when you talk to the general public about homelessness, somebody's sleeping in a car or sleeping in a tent or sleeping in a shelter would be kind of, or a runaway teen who is right. truly transient would be our kind of typical definition of homeless. I think most people would not consider that, you know, mom and dad got evicted and now they're staying with grandma would actually make that person without a home,
yeah.
even if it's not maybe the ideal living situation or they are transitory. And kind of moving that way, and they're not permanently settled. Having lived in some of those situations, I don't consider having a roof with grandma homeless. I right. would consider living in a tent right. homeless. So, can we clarify maybe where that language came yes. from, and maybe and is there a way to extrapolate a more realistic number of yeah. what truly homeless is versus?
Yeah. So, Madam Chair and Representative Parrish. So, interestingly enough, are the federal aid? We don't control these definitions, and they drive us crazy. So, the one for homeless school children is driven by the U.S. Department of Education, and they want a consistent count, and they tell state departments of education how to do it. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which you would think would be in charge, says, no, don't count it that way. You must count more along the ways that you're describing, literally homeless or in shelter or not, sort of transitional housing. They'll allow some version of transitional housing. Order of magnitude, when we did the total number of homeless people in Oregon by the HUD definition is about 14,000 as of the last count, which was actually about a year ago now. We haven't distilled this year's numbers. And you can see that that's a really different number from this school children only that are considered homeless. So it is a crazy-making system. We don't control either of those systems in Oregon. Point taken.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Starr?
Thank you, Chair. One more level of detail, if mm-hmm. you will, when you're getting the information to Rep. Taylor on this is I would love to see out of that 18,902, how many of those children are considered with intact families, as in they're homeless but with a parent, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, truly a street kid on their own without their parents.
Yeah,
if you're
question.
Able to come up with that detail, I'd appreciate that as well.
Great question, Madam Chair and Representative Starr. We'll try and see what the data has underneath there. It's a great question.
That's great. One more question. We've got one more thing on our agenda before closing.
Margaret, I'm sure you've seen the Oregonian series on homelessness, and one of the interesting facts has been the marked increase in the number of homeless in Oregon in the last year,
yep.
Even as the recession improves. Mm-hmm. Is that a sampling error, or a definitional difference, or are there really more homeless people now than at the depths of the recession?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Buehler, I think it's some of both. I think the jurisdictions are getting better at counting and finding people. So it may be that in past years, the count, I mean, they literally, people go out on one night in January and count. You, if you read the series, you know all about this. We as a system are getting better and more savvy about accurately counting and bringing people, going to where they are, camping, and bringing them in to get a hot meal and doing the count. So I think there's some of that going on. And I also think that there are more people. I mean, the economy and the recession did leave more people more devastated. And I think it's just the recovery is lagging when it comes to people literally living on the street. There's also issues around mental health and addiction, and people, if you've been evicted or you do not present well, if you will, to a landlord, makes it hard to get into stable housing, and then that perpetuates chronic homelessness. Really complicated factors in there, but we, from where we sit, we do think the problem is getting worse, and we think, although we control a very small slice of money to address it, we think our policies ought to behave as though it's getting worse, and we ought to respond accordingly.
Okay. Thank you so much. We'll be hearing lots more about housing. I'll close the informational hearing on housing and open a public session on House Bill 2610. And Rick, could you please read for us the summary?
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2610 specifies jurisdiction over safety and health inspection standards for agricultural workforce housing, defines circumstances and procedure to obtain abatement and refund of applicable property taxes.
So we have Representative Gallegos. Would you like to kick us off here?
Or sure. In the interest of time, with less than 10 minutes, I just will just sit up here. And if we need more time for this particular discussion, I'm sure that the chairperson will reschedule. But I think I just want to say that I'm extremely proud to sponsor this bill. It's on the surface a very simple technical fix, but it carries with it a lot of importance. So I'll let the experts out here talk to us about what that's about.
Okay. Can we please call up Lisa Rogers and John Phillips? Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this bill?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And I'm here because this bill deals with agricultural housing, low-income agricultural housing, which has been a tax exemption under the property tax since about 1973. The condition for some of this housing to be exempt requires it to be safe, a safe place to live, free from fire danger and living conditions. And back when the legislature established this program, they put in the condition that they be certified, these units be certified by the state fire marshal or the Oregon OSHA, Oregon OSHA. Everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Occupational safety and hazards.
So, and that went along for a long time. And really, the law put the responsibility on the county assessors. It said they'll get an application from the people who have these units, and the assessor will take that application. They will go to the fire marshal or OSHA, get the certification, and then exempt the property. Well, the assessors really don't do a lot of certifications for entities. They just, you know, value property. They calculate taxes, and they don't run around getting certifications for this or that. And so they really didn't know what to do exactly. And they started to try to implement this, and they found out that OSHA doesn't supply certifications for safety for those that are community-based, and the state fire marshal doesn't supply certification for those that are not commercial. So they came to a dead end. Most of them they were familiar with because they're in their counties, and they appeared very safe to them, and they knew that they were passing local codes like state and local building codes. So really, for a long time, these properties have been exempt, and there really hasn't been a problem. But our responsibility with the Department of Revenue is to oversee the property tax and the administration of the tax. And so in far as administration, we've been trying to clean out areas where assessors are running around getting certifications for applicants. This was one of those areas. We got a bill together last session, House Bill 2227, and a number of things that bill did, but one of them was to say the assessor's not responsible for getting certifications for people who are applying for exemptions. And this was one of those programs involved. And we had some meetings. We met with housing. We tried to meet with people that were involved. And we knew that there was a fundamental problem, a catch-22 for these organizations, and we had hoped that maybe that could come up in the discussion, but our interest was getting the tax administration piece fixed. For reasons because of the press of session or otherwise, it didn't get addressed. And so the bill passed. It put the onus on the applicants. That just accentuated the problem because now they are facing the problem of not being able to get certifications. They're required to get it from these entities. These entities can't by law provide it, and they're stuck. So we agreed and met during the summer and worked this out in the fall, and we said, you know, we're happy to help explain why we're partly responsible for this, and we want to help figure out a way out so that these places can be safe for people to live in. And so the language has been changed away from the catch-22 situation, and we think it does what it's very doable, and, you know, it provides the safeties that you might be looking for. So I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Madam Chair,
the rest of the committee. My name is Lisa Rogers, and I am here representing Oregon Opportunity Network as a board member and CASA of Oregon as its deputy director. Oregon Opportunity Network is an industry support group that has over 49 housing agencies and over another 150 affiliate members. So I'd like to thank Representative Gallegos for all the work that you've done on this and the rest of the committee for hearing our testimony. When the law changed in 2013, I believe we thought that there was going to be some of these other fixes as well for the oversight piece of it. There are two different kinds of agricultural housing or workforce housing. There's in community-based and then on-farm. And they're both, they're whoever oversees the building of that housing and also the health and safety issues of it are two separate entities. And so this bill is just trying to go ahead and clarify that. So for on-farm, you would still go through OSHA, but for in-community, what we are proposing is that instead, when these properties are built or acquired, they have to go through local building codes, and they are built to a pretty high standard. They meet all health and safety issues. And then the funding sources for these properties are typically local, state, and federal sources. And they all come with a lot of compliance. And so typically every 3 to 5 years, these properties are being reviewed for eligibility of tenants, as well as the quality of the housing. They have to meet a HUD standard, which is a housing quality standard, which is at least what OSHA requires. So it's for that reason we're asking for you to consider House Bill 2610 and support it. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just a real quick one. If it's a cleanup thing and it's not necessarily asking for, you know, new funds to, you know, tax exempt,
right?
Why the referral to revenue, or do we know why we're not just moving it to the floor if there's no
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I think it came here because really it's a policy issue about how you ensure that these places are safe and not really a financial revenue impact situation, because as you correctly noticed, there's no change to the property tax exemption in the bill. There is a provision in Section 6 to provide for some refunds for confusion that occurred last year, and it will clean up, make things right for those folks. But otherwise, there's no revenue impact.
Well, that's a good question about why it's referred on to revenue. Maybe they want to see everything that has to do with tax exemption or tax credits. But, yeah, Representative Stark.
Thank you. So I just wanted to clarify, based off of what you said a minute ago, these are properties that already qualify for this exemption, and it makes it just so they can get their certification. So in any way, does this bill expand the number of properties that would qualify for a tax exemption?
Of the ones that currently exist, no. But when new properties are built that are specifically for farm worker, then it would add to that role.
So that might be why it would be referred
to
revenue.
But this bill doesn't.
This is more of a definition, and it's a compliance issue.
Right. So this bill doesn't so right now, the units that are on farmland and the units that are in the community can take advantage of this. But the problem is the ones that happen to be in the community can't get that certification because OSHA doesn't oversee them. So when we first set up farm worker housing, it mostly was on farms. Now that more and more are moving into the community, we hit this problem that I guess we contributed to in 2013, where the OSHA doesn't have jurisdiction over the community. They only do over farms. Is that right?
Yes.
And so we've set up a situation where we've said, well, you're eligible for this tax exemption, but the group that's supposed to certify your safety and health is actually not eligible. They don't have jurisdiction over that particular area. That's how I think I understand it. Is that correct? So it's just a technical fix. It doesn't change the policy in terms of increasing the number of units or increasing where they can be done or anything like that. I think it was an oversight in 2013. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. Yes, that's correct. I don't think it was an oversight. It was just dealing with the tax administration issue at that time and uh-huh. not not the actual policy issue of the catch-22. Really, this problem's been around a while. Nobody was dealing with it.
Okay.
But in fairness to the organizations that are trying to qualify and trying to get that certification, and they just can't because there's no provision for it,
right?
We're trying to fix that.
And partly because this was a little technical fix, we thought this is the first one we'll bite off. We had a lot of big child care, and then we had the overview of housing, and we're going to continue that with the ABC committee report and other bills. This one felt like a very technical one. We actually thought we might be able to move it today, but we don't have the paperwork, so we're not doing the work session. So I will close the public hearing on 2160. 2610. And at our next meeting, we will have the ABC Housing Work Group, and we will be hearing House Bill 2442, which is the agency's reorganization bill, 2620, and HJR 17, which are two of the proposals by the ABC committee. And with that, I adjourn. By the ABC committee.